Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? Today we're speaking with Dr. Allison Lindauer, an assistant professor of neurology at the Schools of Medicine and Nursing at OHSU. She's a nationally certified nurse practitioner with a PhD in gerontological nursing. She cares for Alzheimer's patients at OHSU's Leighton Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center. Is this a woman's disease? Let's hear Dr. Lindauer speak on that. Dr. Lindauer, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us the difference between the OHSU Brain Institute and the Leighton Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center.
Yeah, so the OHSU Brain Institute, the Oregon Brain Institute, is the umbrella term for all the neurology-based research, education, and clinical care that we provide at OHSU. The Leighton Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Center is one of the entities in the OBI umbrella, if you will.
You get part of your funding from the National Institutes of Health, mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, we're one of 30 National Institutes on Aging funded sites across the United States, and we're the only one in Oregon. And we've been funded for over 20 years doing active and important research on Alzheimer's disease, both treatment and management.
One of the sources of confusion on my part, I discovered in our conversation a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. is I didn't know the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Help us out there.
Yeah. So dementia is, again, using the term, it's an umbrella term. And Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia. So if you think about it as ice cream, for example, we know there's ice cream can come in any flavor, so you can have cherry or strawberry or chocolate. So dementia is like that big term, the big ice cream term, and then there are different flavors of dementia. There's Alzheimer's disease, Lewy body disease, vascular dementia. I could go on and on, but those are the most common.
How common in Oregon is dementia?
We know that 63,000 Oregonians have dementia. Those are people who have been diagnosed. We don't know who else is out there. There's probably quite a few more people out there that haven't been diagnosed, so that number's actually quite bigger.
Did you tell me, Doctor, that 1 in 10 Americans over the age 65?
1 in 10 people in the United States have dementia. It's a big problem.
Talk about a specific example. Of course, I know you can't use names, but in your experience, what happens? What is it like to work with a patient who feels that they have dementia and their family when they come to see you? What's the diagnosis, the treatment, mm-hmm. the outcome? What do we go through?
Typically, in the best case scenario, it's typically a daughter who's expressed concern about her mother's memory. As we talked earlier, dementia is a woman's problem. 2/3 of people with dementia are women, and 2/3 of the people that take care of those with dementia are women. So when a woman comes in, they'll typically come in with their mother, and they'll say things like, she used to be a really great cook, but now she can't quite make soup, or she can't even operate the microwave anymore, or she gets lost driving, and I'm worried about her. You had a really important word in there with the word family. We really need family members to come into these visits because they're the ones that really help us put the puzzle together. Many times people with dementia will not have a lot of wonderful insight into their situation. So you may ask them, how are you doing? How's your memory? And they'll say, I'm fine. But then the daughter will lean back in the chair and say, oh, no, she's not.
Why is this so? Does anyone know why this is more common among women? You say 2/3 of the Alzheimer's cases are women?
Mm-hmm. We don't know why it's more common in women. There's certainly some theories that I'm not quite familiar with, but it does point to the fact that the funding for Alzheimer's research has been fairly low over the last couple of decades. So there's a great deal that we don't know about Alzheimer's and other dementias.
Well, let's go back to that case. You say that the mm-hmm. family comes in, mm-hmm. the potential patient. How do you know that they have Alzheimer's? How do you diagnose it?
We work with a team, so the neurologist will typically do a careful assessment to make sure that there aren't other things that are causing a memory problem. So, for example, maybe the person drinks too much alcohol and that's affecting their function. We'll have a neuropsychologist do an assessment, and we will also do memory testing while they're in the clinic. In our practice, typically what we'll do is we'll have case conference where we talk about each case to make sure that we got the diagnosis right. As you know, at this point in time, there is no specific test that we can do, no blood test, no brain scan that we can do that says, absolutely, this is Alzheimer's. We're getting closer. Our scans are getting better. But a lot of the diagnostic process is making sure that we're not missing something else and putting the pieces of the puzzle together as a team.
Are you interested in family history when you diagnose? I mean, is this hereditary?
There are some hereditary components, but what I tell families is if your parents have dementia, there is a slight chance that you will, but don't lose sleep over it because it's not a direct correlation. If your mom had Alzheimer's, it doesn't mean you will. There are some very rare cases of hereditary dementia, hereditary Alzheimer's in young people that is hereditary, that is genetic. But most people, it's not genetic.
So you diagnose it. I guess your team kind of gets together and looks at all aspects of the symptoms.
Yeah, we have a really special team at the Layton Center. We have our neurologist, myself, a nurse practitioner. We have a neuropsychologist, and we have a social worker. And all of us try to help the families navigate this difficult course. We do things like help them learn how to use medications to their advantage, stop medications that may be harmful, talk about social support so we can protect caregivers from strain and burden, and help people navigate when they get close to the end of life and how to make those good decisions to have a peaceful death.
So these people come in, and one of them has Alzheimer's, and you talk through these issues. What do they do? What's your treatment? What are you going to tell them what do you recommend?
So the last drug that was developed for Alzheimer's disease was in 2003. And those are the class of drugs we typically use are acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. They aren't wonderful drugs. They don't cure Alzheimer's. They don't even really improve memory. The drugs are designed to slow progression so that people are more functional at the end of life. So we'll talk to families about those things, but we'll also talk to them about the things that they can change. For example, are they taking medications that may be making their thinking cloudy, like many sleep medications can do that?
Is there a promising line of research in drugs?
Yeah, there is some research. We will ask families if they want to be part of a clinical trial. There are several trials that we're doing up at OHSU. One of them is the A4 study that looks at how antibodies can protect the brain from Alzheimer's. One of the studies looks at how we can address the tau proteins, part of the proteins that affect the brain and can cause Alzheimer's. We also have studies that support caregivers, people that really in the trenches, so to speak. And we also refer people to the Alzheimer's Association. The Alzheimer's Association is a wonderful source of support and information to help families along this path.
ALZ, is that the website?
ALZ.org. Families can also call their 800 number 24 hours a day. That it's staffed by master's prepared counselors, and they're available 24/7, and their number is 1-800-272-3900. And I typically will tell families, even if you don't know what you're going to ask them for, just pick up the phone and call the number, and they'll know what to do.
Well, I can just say from looking at their website, there's a wealth of information and statistics. But I didn't ask you, Doctor, what causes Alzheimer's?
Early in the 1900s, Dr. Alzheimer's had a woman as a patient, and he noticed some odd behaviors. For example, she was suspicious that her husband was having an affair. And when she died, he looked at the cells in her brain and identified these classic amyloid plaques and tau tangles that affect how brain cells communicate.
Wait a minute, what's that word you're using, tau tangles?
Uh-huh.
What's that mean, tau tangles?
It's how the proteins in the brain kill the cells help us think clearly.
Okay. T-A-O.
T-A-U.
T-A-U. Mm-hmm. Tau tangles.
Yes. So it's the plaques and the tangles that break the communication between the cells.
And what causes those things to grow or multiply or whatever they do?
We don't know for sure. Again, because of funding issues, we still aren't sure. There are some theories out there, but I'm probably not the best person to expand on those theories.
Okay. You were saying that there are promising areas of research. Do you expect a drug breakthrough?
We hope so. We hope that in the early, by 2020, we'll have something. But boy, it's a lot of work. And as you know, it takes years to get drugs through clinical trials to make sure they're safe and effective. So the drugs that we're testing now, even those, it may not be ready until, 2025. We do know, however, there has been some wonderful research on exercise, and we know that people can help prevent dementia by exercising 4 to 5 times a week, and they break a sweat. And we know that that helps the brain, it helps the circulation, and it tends to prevent Alzheimer's, not always, but it can. And we know that people who have some memory trouble, it can help their brains as well.
Good news.
Yeah,
good news.
It is good news.
Did you tell me that 35% of what causes Alzheimer's can be controlled?
Yes, yes. About 35% of what causes Alzheimer's, we can help. So, for example, hearing loss contributes about 9% of the risk to Alzheimer's disease. So in our clinic, we make sure that people have their hearing tested.
Wait a minute. Is it because people get isolated because they can't hear, or is there some correlation between hearing loss and the onset of Alzheimer's?
We're not entirely sure. We do think that there's something about the isolation. And also, if you can't hear something, you can't remember it. It's taking stuff into the brain. The other theory is that when we have hearing loss, a lot of our brain space, so to speak, is focusing on what the person is saying. And so we're distracted. We know that people who use hearing aids, however, can reduce their risk of developing Alzheimer's. So getting your hearing checked is really important. So exercise. And good sleep is also very important. People with sleep apnea have a higher risk of developing dementia. We really want to be able to treat those people early so we can protect their brains.
Well, why is that? Is there any theory as to how lack of sleep could contribute to onset of Alzheimer's?
The theory, I believe, is rooted in the lack of oxygen when there's apneic episodes.
Let's talk about the caregiver issues. Mm-hmm. You work a lot with families, right?
Mm-hmm, we do.
Well, what's it like for the family of a patient with Alzheimer's? You said this is a woman's disease a lot because so many of the caregivers are women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's it like for the caregiver's family?
It's a very interesting and unique experience. It tends to, as we said, be women, but I do work with a lot of men. And what I think that the thing that's very hard is it's a very long commitment. People can have Alzheimer's disease for 10, 15 years, and so it's a chronic state of worry. And that chronic state of worry and burden affects the health of the caregivers and puts caregivers at risk for developing dementia themselves.
Not to interrupt, but is there some figure on the longevity of a person after being diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Is there a typical length of life after that?
It can be 2 to 10 years.
Right.
Yeah, depending on where we diagnose them. We do have people who, will be diagnosed fairly early. They'll be fairly healthy, and they can live another 20 years.
But Alzheimer's itself doesn't cause death. Is that right?
Technically, it can, because it gradually destroys the brain, and eventually it'll destroy the part of the brain that affects, for example, swallowing and breathing. But what typically happens is people don't die of Alzheimer's, they die with Alzheimer's. What's important to us is to have the community ask their doctors to put dementia, and if they know the type, if it's Alzheimer's, on the death certificate so we can get good measures of who's dying with this disease.
Okay, I interrupted you, and we were talking about the caregivers and how they fit into this picture and how you work with them and what you recommend for that?
So what I do recommend for all caregivers is to find time for themselves and to give themselves breaks. The other thing that I recommend to all my caregivers is to contact the Alzheimer's Association. They have wonderful support systems for caregivers, as well as classes like art classes and music classes for people with dementia to help their brains. And the other thing I do with caregivers at the Layton Center is we do video conferencing-based studies to see if we can support caregivers via telehealth. So caregivers are certainly welcome to give us a call to see if they're eligible for those studies. And if you'd like, I can give you that number right now.
Yeah, let me make sure I understand. Mm-hmm. This is a situation where someone not in our geographic area mm-hmm. would try to get your help as a caregiver, get your advice and input.
Yeah, and they're fairly structured studies, but we know that these types of interventions reduce caregiver burden and improve quality of life. And typically, these programs are programs where you would drive to, for example, the Alzheimer's Association and sit down with a group of people. Not everybody can do that. Travel may be a problem. The person with dementia may have behavior symptoms. And so we're trying to offer these options via telehealth. These are studies, so not everybody will be eligible, but we are looking for people for the studies.
How many people like this do you deal with, say, on a weekly basis?
My own study is a fairly small study. I have about 12 people in that study, but it's a very intensive study, and I'm hoping to get funding for a much larger study. There is another study out of Emory University that the Layton Center has teamed up with. It's called TeleSavvy, and that's a national study, and we're looking for anybody in the nation that wants to be part of this study, any caregiver. And if people are interested, same thing. There's many ways to get to the Layton Center to learn about us, but we do have one phone number that will get you whatever you need.
And what's that?
That's the 503-494-6976. And you can look us up on the web as well. It's at ohsu.edu/Alzheimer's.
And if somebody were here in Portland, mm-hmm. they could simply come into the center and
sure.
try and get work with you. Is that right?
Certainly. Yeah. It's there are lots of ways to access us. And like I said earlier, we do work closely with the Alzheimer's Association. So if a family's stressed out and having a tough time, we will turn to the Alzheimer's Association to help us. If we can help, we will.
You're looking to expand your telehealth practice.
It makes sense. Anybody with a computer and an internet connection should be able to get the support they need. The caregivers I've worked with have been all over the state of Oregon, and, they tell me it takes the stress out of getting help.
Just to be able to speak with someone,
yeah.
get another professional yeah. perspective.
Yeah. It's very important. The other thing I wanted to touch on, Tom, that I think is important is that you had mentioned with the hearing issue is social activity is really important. At every stage of our lives it is. And if people are an introvert, they shouldn't feel guilty. But doing things that they enjoy, like playing Scrabble or dancing or playing music, is very important for the brain. We often tell people, go get out your old trumpet and start playing it and have a little fun with it. You'll notice in the summertime in Portland, there are pianos scattered around Portland. It's an organization called Piano Push Play, and you'll see these beautiful pianos everywhere you go, and they will delight you. So we know that, again, that the getting outside, being with friends and family, doing the things you love are very important to the brain. People will often ask me, Allison, should I do brain games? Like those electronic games, like, am I allowed to say, like Luminosity, for example. What we know about those games, again, the research is suggesting they may be helpful, but what the scientists tell us is if you enjoy the games, certainly play them. If you don't enjoy the games, don't play them. Do things you love. Don't feel guilty for not playing the game. Spend time with grandchildren. Go for a walk. It's just as good for your brain as a brain game.
I'm promoting dancing.
Dancing. Me too. I'm a dancer, so that's very near and dear to my heart.
Okay. Now, your group also does clinical trials. Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
We do.
I'd like to understand how one could get into a clinical trial and mm-hmm. what would be expected and what it might accomplish.
Yes. So people who come to us who want to be in a clinical trial soon realize that it's a very important piece of what we do at the Layton Center, but it's not always an easy path. We will bring people in and we'll screen them to see if they fit the criteria. Each clinical trial has multiple criteria that we have to abide by. We can't change the criteria because the drug companies are the ones that set it. So oftentimes a person will come in, we'll do memory testing, we'll draw blood, and then maybe after we've gone through all the criteria, we'll tell a person, yes, you're eligible or no, you're not. If they are eligible, we will hook them up with our research assistants and research team who will make sure that they get the right drug at the right time. Sometimes people will be randomized to a placebo, and none of us know if at the Layton Center if they're getting the drug or the placebo. The other thing that happens sometimes is people are very eager to be in a study and they can't get in a study and they're very disappointed. We tell people just to stay in touch with us because there are new studies all the time, and oftentimes they're not eligible for one study, they may be eligible for another.
So in order to find out whether there's a study that mm-hmm. might be appropriate and how to get into it is simply to call. Or do you have a website?
Yeah, you can certainly call our number, the 503-494-6976. And our team will answer the phone and they'll ask you a series of questions and they'll help us get you into the database so that if you want to be in research, we will find you. You can also learn quite a bit about us at our website, which is ohsu.edu/Alzheimer's. And one of the things that we run into a lot is people don't know how to spell Alzheimer's. So I'll spell it for you. ohsu.edu/ALZHEIMERS.
All right, that's our spelling bee for today. So, I mean, listeners, if you find that there's no study available at the time that you call and you're interested, get into the database mm-hmm. and there will be one or maybe one that comes up down the road a little bit.
And the Alzheimer's Association also has a clinical trials database that you can sign up for online. So that's another option. There's a lot of momentum these days to fund Alzheimer's research, to address the issue. It is the most expensive disease in the United States of America, and our government is really beginning to realize this. So you will be seeing, I hope, more studies coming out.
You told me that the goal of the association is to cure this disease by 2020. Is mm-hmm. that right?
Yes.
Do you think that's possible?
Frankly, I don't think we're going to find a cure. I'm hoping that we can find some type of treatment that will modify the disease. But we all are very hopeful for a cure. That's keeps us going.
Do you have anything I should have asked you? Anything on your mind?
You know, I think one of the things that I do want to emphasize is that people will often ask me, you know, how do I prevent this? And we talked about it earlier. We talked about the exercise and social engagement. The other thing we do is tell people, you know, stop smoking, be mindful of how much alcohol you drink. Just try to lead a somewhat healthy lifestyle, but have fun while you're doing it.
Sounds like some good advice. Mm-hmm. Don't forget to dance every now and then.
Absolutely.
Doctor, thanks so much for joining us on KBOO today.
A true pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Allison Lindauer, Assistant Professor of Neurology at the Schools of Medicine and Nursing at OHSU. And here's a younger old guy, Alan Julian, who works as a volunteer at the Hollywood Center. You'll hear him speak about gentrification and its impact on older folks in Portland, including himself and the Latino community. Alan, tell me, what's it like getting old in Portland? How old are you?
65.
Oh, you're a young guy. But you look forward to X number of more years here, is it?
Well, I would like to stay in Portland, but unfortunately, it's becoming more and more expensive, and a lot of seniors are having problems with housing or being forced out because of high rents or higher taxes. gentrification, basically. Same with the communities of color. It's economics. Bottom line is economics. If you're on Social Security, a limited income, it's becoming more and more unaffordable. I don't know where they're moving to because Gresham is also becoming more expensive and Beaverton. So
where are you going to move to, or do you have any idea?
I don't know. Maybe Vancouver, a smaller town. I'm not sure. I would like to stay in Portland because I think there's a lot of things going on, and I enjoy the city.
Did you grow up here?
I went to high school in Beaverton and Portland, and then I left and lived in the Southwest in Texas, Mexico, and California, and then came back. Basically, I left California for the same reason, the Bay Area, for the same reason that's happening now, which is gentrification and high rents. Sometimes I volunteer for the legal clinic here, and many of the people come in are dealing with eviction notices. And also people coming in looking for housing, affordable housing.
Do you feel like the city's doing what it needs to do, or is there anything the city should be doing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They need to work more on affordable housing and making sure that our communities don't disappear and all become gentrified. They really need to hold the builders who are mostly out of state come in and build, and they're not thinking about the local situation at all. They're interested in how much rent they can get. So I think they need to stake out communities and say, we can't force all these people out. And I think rent control is really necessary for certain communities in particular. I think there's a move in that direction, but I think the city is moving too slowly. I think they put too many barriers up for affordable housing.
Alan, you speak Spanish, and your program on Cable back in those days was in Spanish.
Yeah.
What about the Latin community here? How is that affected?
A lot of them who had smaller communities here have moved out to the more of the outlying areas. So, again, it's becoming less diverse. You really have to search, because the Latino community is not in one specific area of Portland. There's a lot of Latinos out in Gresham, in Hillsborough, Cornelius, out in those areas, and more of them are moving out because it's more affordable. But even out there, it is becoming less affordable.
If you had to single out a couple of things that you really like about being an older person here in Portland, what would they be?
I think it's fairly livable. I think our transportation system is fairly good. I think there's a lot more activities that are accessible in Portland, though they are also becoming more expensive. But there are things that go on in Portland. Plus, I think the activity politically is more interesting in Portland than a lot of places. I think we're generally, in quotes, progressive city. We'll have to see what the future does, but I think we need to keep leaning on the city council. I think our police department is another issue that we need to look at and really push them to be more accountable to the communities. We need to look at ways to keep the communities and provide services to those communities.
That was Alan Julian speaking on gentrification. Next time, you'll hear Dr. Susan Toll, a nationally known bioethicist and geriatric doctor, speaking on a system she created that helps people say exactly what kind of treatments they want at the end of life. Don't miss it. You've been listening to our series on aging in Portland, retired or rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.